Be still and know that I am God. Be still and know that I am. Be still and know. Be still. Be.
Be still and know that I am God. Be still and know that I am. Be still and know. Be still.
Be.
Be still and know that I am God. Be still and know that I am. Still and know, be still, be.
Can you hear me? Welcome. I'm Anna Grotenhaus. I'm a member of the steering committee and very happy to see all of you. And I will tell you, it's been a very challenging, interesting 8 weeks. When the steering committee decided to tackle this topic, I was very concerned. I thought, well, it's going to be a long, cold winter if we're going to be studying evil. But what has happened is I have learned a great deal. I hope you have too. I've been enlightened from many of our speakers about what it means to confront this shadow side of humanity. And anyway, I hope you feel the same about this series. Last week, we had Buddy Parker here, and he talked a lot about our country's history and the Constitution. And it was disturbing to be reminded how the faces of evil are embedded in our culture since the very beginning. I thought it was fascinating, and I really appreciate Buddy's input, and I have listened 3 times to what he said, and we will continue. Today, we have 2 wonderful friends of Word and Life. We have Steve Jacobson, who has spoken at Word and Life many times, and we have Rabbi Steve Cohen. And I know you have much to say about this topic. I'm going to tell you a little bit about Steve. Steve has been a parish pastor for over 30 years. He served also in the nonprofit sector for many years, first as executive director of Hospice of Santa Barbara, and then as director of La Casa de Maria until retiring in 2018. He is currently the interim pastor at Summerlin Presbyterian Church, and I must say he's doing a fantastic job there. He's a member of the Strategic Advisory Council for Santa Barbara Neighborhood Clinics, and he's a member of the New Day Task Force working on the reopening of La Casa de Maria. That's a wonderful endeavor that we're all looking forward to. He writes a weekly blog called Pocket Epiphanies. He has 3 adult children, 4 grandchildren. He enjoys baseball, classical music, and the Pacific Ocean. Rabbi Steve Cohen is a native of Rochester, New York. He has served as the senior rabbi of Congregation B'nai B'rith since 2004. And then after 19 years as the rabbi and executive director of Hillel Foundation at UC Santa Barbara. He and his wife, Marion, have been married since 1986. They have 2 grown children and 1 grandchild. In 2013, Steve and Marion took up long distance backpacking, hiking the entire 211 miles of the John Muir Trail. That's impressive, I have to tell you. I know that trail, through the High Sierra. Since then, they have returned often to the Sierras, as well as to the backcountry of Santa Barbara. In his free time, I don't know how you have any, but in your free time, Steve enjoys studying the Torah with friends, going to movies, identifying wildflowers, listening to a wide range of music and davening at sunrise with the birds in his backyard. Welcome to both of you. And now we will have our traditional song of blessing for today, and the whole gallery can join in as we sing.
We bless you as you share your gifts of spirit, light, and insight. We welcome you with joy.
Take it away.
Okay, I'm going to do a little introduction before my wonderful friend, Mr. Cohen, Rabbi Cohen, is going to speak. I'm going to say a little bit about our background together. We started meeting at the Natural Cafe on Hollister in Old Town Goleta when Steve was pretty soon coming into B'nai B'rith. And we used to meet just to explore parish dynamics and everything. And we both learned that he has a youngest son named Ari, and I have a daughter named Aria. They both went to Dos Pueblos, ended up both going to UC Santa Cruz. And we both ordered fish tacos that time. So there's some common threads that started pretty early.
So much in common.
But then we've been involved in things, and it's been such a blessing. After 9/11, we got involved in Interfaith Initiative, and Steve's congregation and mine and the Islamic Society of Santa Barbara started doing a lot of things together, which really led to a very rich time. I remember one night, Steve, we had the Interfaith Passover Seder up at B'nai B'rith, up there on the hill. I'd guess 150 people. And at 7, we all went outside, and you could pray. You could do Hebrew prayers, Arabic prayers, Islamic prayers, or Christian prayers. And it was a starry night in Santa Barbara, and you could hear all these languages going under the stars. And it felt like heaven. It felt like, you know, the human community. Everybody could go which place they wanted, but everybody was there. And then things continued. And then after, I think, especially after the Pittsburgh synagogue shootings and Poway, Steve had a vision called Creating the Human Family, which was to do a lot of proactive things across religious ethnic lines. So Alice McDonald, who's part of Word and Life, she was involved in that early on. And a lot of exciting stuff was happening, and then COVID came. So anyway, but Steve and I have continued to, he's a real hiker. I kind of traipse along. We go along every so often and have nice long talks. But it's not gonna be so much a dialogue with Steve and me today. I met with him last week. I kind of updated him a lot of what we've been talking about. And as we talked about options, I think it's really important for everybody to hear Steve's very rich perspective, which I think will come as very fresh and important. And as we talked, he thought he will talk about some Jewish holidays. So I'm going to turn it over to Steve, and I'll come back at the end, but I think most of the time it'll be with Rabbi Cohen.
Thank you, Steve. And thank you, everybody, for inviting me today. And it's nice to see some old friends here. Tim Burnett was also part of the Human Family effort. And Alice, it's great to see you again. So as much as Steve has said to me several times, you know, this really needs to be you primarily. And, you know, I won't be satisfied if I don't get a chance to learn from Steve a little bit this morning as well. So I'm hoping that there will be some opportunity for at least a little bit of dialogue. I guess to begin with, I want to offer what may be a sort of standard caveat, or maybe not, but I want to begin just by emphasizing that, you know, Judaism as a tradition it's vast and it's ancient, and with regard to any profound question, and the question of evil is definitely one of the great profound questions, there is no single Jewish answer. And that would be true of any of the great questions that you know, that human beings have struggled with in our past. And so what you'll hear from me today is, you know, it's one rabbi's voice. It's my attempt to make some sense of this question, you know, based on, you know, a long career and lifetime of reading and thinking and learning from others, So it's not that this is stuff that I've made up out of thin air, but it's is one rabbi's perspective. And it would be a mistake to regard anything that I say as being representative of all of Judaism or even all of Reform Judaism, which is the denomination of Judaism that I'm in. The problem of evil is a huge question for Jewish thought. And I guess one way of boiling it down is this: if God is the creator of everything, then where does evil come from? And I want to just share one particular sort of textual place where the tension around this shows up in what I think is a very poignant way, which is that some of you may be familiar with the verse from Isaiah, Isaiah chapter 45, verse 7, where God says, "You know, I am the Eternal, Ani Adonai, Yotzer Or Uvarei Choshech, Creator of Light and Maker of Darkness, Ose Shalom Uvorei Ra, who makes peace, Shalom, and who creates Ra." And Ra is the Hebrew word that is almost always translated as evil. And so in this verse from Isaiah, God, or the prophet, speaks for God, saying, identifying God as the creator not only of light and darkness, but also of peace and of evil. And the most interesting thing about this verse from a Jewish perspective is that it is quoted in our daily prayers, every morning in our daily prayers, and it's a very central location. It's the beginning of the morning creation prayer. The author of our prayers, and we don't even know who that person was, but whoever it was that wrote the prayers and almost 2,000 years ago, quotes that line. We begin the prayer by saying, Baruch Ata Adonai Eloheinu Melech HaOlam, you know, blessed are you, Adonai, our God, majesty of the universe. And then quoting verbatim the verse from Isaiah, Yotzer Or Uvorei Choshech, creator of light and maker of darkness. And then the prayer, Ose Shalom, maker of peace. And then the prayer book, the author of the prayers could not accept Isaiah's formulation. And so where Isaiah had God saying that I am the maker of peace and the creator of evil, the prayer book substitutes and says, I am a maker of peace and creator of everything. Because it was intolerable for the editor of the prayer book, and you know, and for all later generations of Jews, could not accept the idea that evil comes from God. So I just offer that, you know, as a starting point to illustrate how intense the dilemma is. If God is creator of everything, then where does evil come from? And Isaiah had one way of addressing it. Our Jewish prayer book follows Isaiah, but doesn't follow Isaiah quite to the end, and ends up by saying God is creator of everything and leaves it at that. The second sort of thing to say by way of introduction is that, you know, human beings, according to the Torah and according to Jewish tradition, are created in the image of God. And so what about us? You know, is evil an essential part of who we are or not? And this sort of leads me into a few words about rabbinic, sort of classic Jewish psychology. And I want to offer, at this point, I want to offer a little bit of a distinction, which is, this is something that I haven't really seen articulated exactly this way, but it's my own sort of approach, and it is based on a lot of years and years and years of reading and learning, which is, I would offer a distinction between what we might call normal evil and radical evil. And in classic rabbinic Jewish psychology, the human being is seen as sort of a battleground between two impulses, what are called Yetzer HaTov and Yetzer HaRa, the good impulse and the evil impulse. And this is the way that the rabbis talk about us human beings all the time, that we have these two impulses, and they are sort of constantly battling within us, the impulse to do good, the impulse to do evil. And what's interesting, or one of the things that's interesting about some of the Talmudic, the comments by the Jewish sages in the Talmud, are that they take the Yetzer Hara, the evil impulse, they take it seriously, and they see it as a source of tremendous suffering and chaos, in our lives, in the world, but they also have an appreciation for it. And it's expressed perhaps most famously in a comment by a rabbi. The rabbi's name is Shmuel Bar Nachman, in the Talmud. It's his comment on the end of the story of creation in Genesis, Genesis chapter 1, where, after every creation, God says, where it says that God's Vayar Elohim Kitov, God saw that it was good. And this is God's response to every element of the creation. And then at the very end of after the creation of human beings, it says God saw everything that he had made, and v'hine tov me'od, and behold, it was very good. And Rabbi Shmuel Bar Nachman says, what's that very? What's the me'od? What's very? What does that refer to? What does it mean in that moment? Shmuel Bar Nachman says that very is speaking about the evil impulse. And there's a, as often happens in the Talmud, there's a sort of a debate that immediately begins. And, how can you say that Yetzer Hara, that the evil impulse, is what is described as very good? And his response is, well, without Yetzer Hara, nobody would ever build a house. Nobody would ever get married. Nobody would ever have children, and nobody would ever engage in business. And so there's this, and this is a famous teaching that is well known in Jewish tradition, that the Yetzer Hara, this what we call the evil impulse, is bound up with our creative, it's what drives us to make things happen in our own lives and in the world. And so this is, I would say, the Jewish view of what I'm calling normal evil. Doesn't mean that we're supposed to constantly pursue our evil impulse or to allow it free rein, but it's to acknowledge its importance in our lives. Now I want to move on to radical evil. And from a Jewish point of view, at this moment in our history, radical evil can be summed up in the single word Auschwitz, which, for anybody who has studied 20th century history and the Holocaust, and for anybody who knows something, even a little bit, of what the reality was at Auschwitz and the other extermination camps during the Holocaust, it suffices, that single word suffices to point to a reality of evil that is not normal. and a reality that existed for millions of Jews, in which truly the presence of all goodness, all meaning, certainly all holiness had vanished from the world. And God was experienced as having vanished from the world. From an American history point of view, you know, I would say that the reality of the slave trade and the brutality and the violence that was the engine of the 400 years of slave trade points to the reality of radical evil, not normal evil, but radical evil. And I know that, you know, my sense is that this has really been your topic this winter. So I want to try to offer a few thoughts about, you know, how Judaism begins to confront what I'm calling radical evil. First of all, there is a book of the Bible. There is a book of the Bible that depicts a world of radical evil. And you may not even be familiar with it. It's the book of Esther. It's the book of Esther, in which, and you know, and I encourage you to have a look at it. It's not a long book. But in the book of Esther, the Jews find themselves outside of the land of Israel. They are in the middle of exile. They're in exile. It's that exile began as the Babylonian exile, and then the Persians conquered the Babylonians. And so the Jews find themselves in the world of the Persian Empire. And through without taking the time to tell the whole story, a man arises whose name is Haman, or in Hebrew, we pronounce it Haman, who is the prime minister. He's the king's chief advisor. And because of what he experiences as a slight by Mordechai the Jew, Haman decides to decree the annihilation of all Jews in the empire. This really, and you know, we're talking about something like 5th century BCE, but when Jews read this story, we read Auschwitz. It's a decree of extermination. It's the only book of the Bible that talks, that describes that kind of extermination. That kind of decree of extermination, and the in that story, unlike all other stories of redemption in the Jewish Bible, the Jews are not saved by a miracle from God. The Jews, in fact, in the book of Esther, the name of God never appears. It's the only book of the Bible in which God is absent. And the story of the book of Esther is a story in which the Jews save themselves. Now, of course, there are many, many later Jewish commentaries that debate, was God really absent? Was God hiding? You know, where do we see evidence of God in the story? You know, those questions get debated endlessly, but at least in a, as a starting point, the story of Esther is a story of radical evil in which God is absent. And it's, you know, one interesting, profound commentary actually is that the name Esther is taken as a play on words or a pun, or actually a hidden reference to a verse in the Torah, Deuteronomy chapter 31, verses 17 and 18, in which God in at near the end of Deuteronomy, Moses, or speaking for God, describes a time in the future where God will hide his face. And the Hebrew words are aster, astir et panai. Aster, astir et panai. I will surely hide my face. And the some of the later Jewish readers said, ah, the name Esther is actually a connection with that verse back in Deuteronomy. It's that the book of Esther is a story about a time in which God's face is hidden. Now in Judaism, we have an interesting, complicated, baffling, wonderful way of responding to this experience of the eclipse of what Martin Buber calls the eclipse of God, or the hiding of God's face, or the absence of God. And it's the holiday of Purim, which we actually just celebrated. We just celebrated Purim last week. And the Purim is the holiday in which we read the story of Esther. We read the whole book of Esther. And it's the one day in the year, the one day in the entire year where a Jew is supposed to get drunk. The Talmud says, on Purim, a person should get so drunk that they can't distinguish between blessed Mordechai and cursed Haman. Now, later commentary says, oh, what that really means is that, you know, you should get drunk until you fall asleep. And when you're asleep, you can't tell the difference between Haman and Mordechai. But, you know, those are later attempts to sort of make sense of a strange idea. So drunkenness, masks, costumes. There's a old, well-established tradition of Purim spiels, which are a play. They're basically, you know, a play in which people basically turn the world upside down. The main one of the main functions of a Purim spiel is to make fun of the rabbi and, you know, all authority figures. And it's a embrace of absurdity and chaos. We also, when we read the story of Esther, whenever we come to the name of Haman, and it's a, you know, it appears fairly frequently in the book of Esther, whenever we get to Haman's name, everybody, we have noisemakers called a grogger, and everybody, you know, drowns out his name with the noisemakers banging on pots and pans, stamping feet, clapping, you know, all it's a wild night of craziness and silliness and of responding to this radical evil with absurdity, or basically it's the Jewish Mardi Gras. And it's not, or the Jewish Carnival, or the Jewish St. Patrick's Day. You know, it's somehow important that these holidays all happen at the same time. And in Judaism, just as, well, you know, I can't speak about Christianity. It's not my tradition. I don't really know that much about it. But in Judaism, what's essential is that immediately after this day of sort of wildness, we begin a month-long preparation for Passover, which is our holiday of rebirth and of Seder, which means order. So the Jewish liturgical calendar somehow asking us to understand through experience that radical evil will bubble up and there's no adequate response other than, you know, to sort of get through the chaos and the next day begin to rebuild and to move toward a restoration, basically a rebirth of the world, a rebirth of, and specifically a rebirth of the relationship between us and God. Purim is a day of estrangement in some ways between us and God, and Passover is the holiday of the rebirth of the relationship and the restoration of the love relationship between God and human beings. So that's what I've got to share. And Steve, you heard some of this from me a few days ago, and some of it's new, you know, some of it I didn't mention before, but anything there that you want to sort of highlight or object to or question or
sure. You know, first I'll say that Steve often posts his sermons, his Sabbath sermons, on Facebook. So often on Saturday mornings I read them. A year ago with Purim, you had a wonderful piece you wrote about Zelensky and the Ukrainians.
Yeah.
And about how, you know, how there was similarities there.
Yeah.
And that, it was great. And I think the year before on Passover, and I just mentioned this to you, I think last week, but Steve did a sermon in the middle of COVID when things were at their most intense. His Passover sermon was that the tradition where you remember the people that helped deliver you through a time of the angel of death is on the move, that all the frontline workers and all the hospital people and everybody that was they were keeping us alive during this time when death was passing over us, they should be remembered in the Passover story. And I've never forgotten that. It's, you know, so I think this sense of love the way you connect those holidays with the current situation. And it does seem to me that, you know, Father Jim Clark, for those of you who were part of that, talked about how Jung really perceived that a lot of organized religion, including his father, did not want to deal with the shadow side, the more primitive side of us. And it seems to me, Steve, that early rabbinical insight into the two natures from the beginning is like, hey, you know, none of us are pure. Yeah. And it's kind of that shadow coming out. Does that make sense?
Yeah. Yeah. And I, at least the way that I read it, and I think that most modern Jews read the Torah, it's important to recognize that everybody in the Torah, you know, there are no perfect people in the Torah. You know, everybody has you know, this struggle going on within them. And, you know, Moses, for sure, you know, Jacob, Abraham, you know, they're all, you know, and the great women also, you know, Rebecca and Sarah. So anyway, I do feel that that's one of the you know, wisdoms of the Jewish tradition that I appreciate, you know, is that sense of you know, we've all got this within us. Having said that, it is, you know, I feel like it's important for me to acknowledge that there have been many Jewish readers of the Torah and who have struggled, who have had a hard time with that. And so they take stories in the Torah in which, you know, for example, where Jacob lies about, you know, he goes before his blind father and he pretends to be Esau. He, you know, the father, Isaac, says, "Who are you?" And he says, "I'm your firstborn Esau." He lies. And there are definitely rabbinic readers of that text who say, "Oh, you know, he wasn't really lying. He was, you know, sort of telling the truth, but telling it in a oblique way." You know, I think that those readings of the biblical text, I understand the impulse to try to identify the good guys and the bad guys, but I think that ultimately the overall message of at least the Jewish Bible is that we're all a mixture of, you know, competing impulses.
I think between the George Floyd time and the synagogue shooting in Pittsburgh, I've shared this with you, Steve. It's really, last few years have been kind of a very painful eye-opening to me of the depth of anti-Semitism in the Christian tradition. The Poway shooter had gone to a Catholic school. He was in a Presbyterian, a splintered off Presbyterian group, and he read his Bible very carefully. I read it now, and there's so many. I think in the Book of John alone, there's 34 references to the Jews, and the famous in Gospel of Matthew, when Jesus is being condemned, you know, his blood be on us and our children. It's just pain. It's very painful.
Yeah.
To think about that. And it reminds me, you mentioned slavery. I'm reading Frederick Douglass's about his life and how his slave master would take the slaves and they go to the camp meeting, the Methodist camp meeting, at which his master would weep and atone for his sins and be forgiven. And everybody would sing gospel songs. And then he'd take the slaves home and just beat them mercilessly, you know? Mm. And I think in Christianity, I don't know if the tradition is quite as inclusive of the shadow side. I'm not sure. And a lot of you out there, it'd be interesting to have you chime in on that. There's a sense that maybe we can be pure, that Jesus was pure. But looking at the history of whether it's slavery or anti-Semitism in his Christian culture, wow, what a shadow, what a dark, dark, life-demeaning impulse that the religion hasn't purged us of. And so I think, look forward to people's own thoughts about this. You know, how do you accept our capacity for evil while still fighting against it? Yeah.
I appreciate the comments so much, Steve. And, you know, I think that, you know, one of the reasons that I value our friendship is that I really see you as somebody who struggles with that in the, you know, that aspect of the, you know, of the Christian past, the Christian text, from the flip side of it is from the Jewish point of view, there, you know, many Jews are really haunted by the, you know, by the European experience and the past history of anti-Semitism, and see only that. And I think that, you know, part of the journey that I've been on as a rabbi and as a Jew over you know the decades of my life has been, you know, to really come to be aware and come to an appreciation of the, you know, the real challenge facing a Christian who, you know, may have parts of their own past or of the past, the Christian past, you know, that they are grappling with, but then also to see that, you know, we Jews have to do our own grappling with, you know, voices in the text that we are uncomfortable with, that we are disturbed by, that we're in fundamental disagreement about, and this all feels like such important work to do. And at the end of the day, I guess, you know, I will say that this was, I think, the great idea behind the Human Family Project, and with the idea being that we are just not served by viewing the world, you know, in terms of us and them. And yet there have been in the past, and there still are today, you know, so many Jews, Christians, Muslims, you know, we've all got, you know, all of these voices in our communities that are saying, you know, we are, you know, God is on our side, and you know, there are the wicked out there who we're in opposition to, and I find much more helpful the idea that evil or wickedness is something that is part of all of us, and collectively we have to work against it, and we don't do it by separating the world into the, you know, the tzaddikim, the righteous and the wicked. So
I agree. Are we about ready to break? What do you think, Tim and Judith? Good time?
Certainly, yeah. Either of you like to read the questions that I just put in the chat so that can be our invitation to conversation in breakout rooms?
Sure. Does a Jewish view that we all have the potential for good and evil within us help you make sense of the world? And part of the same question, how does it relate to some of the perspectives we've been exploring, including Cynthia's definition? So this idea that we all have good and evil, after these 8 weeks, where do you see that connecting? How does that relate to Cynthia? And the second question, Rabbi Cohen suggested that the Jewish calendar reflects ancient wisdom. Our life will benefit by returning again and again to the same stories, Purim and Passover, to see what lessons they have to teach us in the present. How do you see the themes of Purim and Passover playing out in our current culture? So just thinking of those holidays as the way Steve described it, and what relevance do you find for that in terms of the modern age? If I'm correct, Steve, I've heard you say that Torah is perfect in every way, but constantly needs to be reinterpreted in every generation, or something like that.
Good enough.
Good enough. Okay. But I mean, this idea that, you know, the stories are there, they're perennial stories,
right,
but they keep coming back, and every time, gosh, here it is again. There's a new way to look at that, and I think that's why you and I love texts.
Yes.
You know, and we love that devotion to the texts, is because they have that ability to illuminate. Okay, those are the two questions, and look forward to, hope everybody has a great discussion.